Yes, yes. There will be a terrible stench. But this is a gift from Toranaga-sama. It must be the best pheasant this village has ever prepared. Now, this next part is very important. No one is to touch this bird.
Welcome to Shogun, the official podcast. I'm Emily Yoshida, and I was a writer on this series. And each week, after every episode, I'll be diving deeper into the biggest twists and behind-the-scenes stories from the FX series with co-creators Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo, along with the cast and crew that helped bring this story to life. Today, we'll be talking about Episode 5, Broken to the Fist. And you know the deal by now, lots of spoilers for this and all previous episodes ahead. On the podcast today, I'll hear about what it was like to perform in a landslide with Cosmo Jarvis. We'll learn the reason behind Uejiro the Gardener's death with actor Moeka Hoshi, who plays Fuji. And we'll learn the dark symbolism of Buntaro's archery stunt with producer Mako Kamitsuna. But first, we need to talk about that dinner.
We used to call it the dinner date from hell.
Yes.
Just of like the worst perfect storm group of characters to have to put together at the worst possible time in their story.
That's showrunner Justin Marks. The unforgettable centerpiece of this week's episode is the dinner between Blackthorn, Buntaro, Mariko, and Fuji, a pressure cooker of a scene that ends up revealing something about every character in the room, starting with Mariko.
Mariko, up to this point in the story, has been such a mystery when it comes to the specifics of what lies beneath the surface of her family, of her own role in all of this. You know, we've had allusions to it as early as the first episode when it comes to, you know, what baggage is Mariko carrying with her. But for the first time to finally understand who her father was, what he did, you know, and really in a lot of ways, to really understand more about the marriage to Mariko and Buntaro and just how complex it is because of what her father did.
Yeah. I mean, we understand there's this sort of resentment between Mariko and Buntaro, and we certainly understand why, at least from Mariko's end, just judging from the interactions we've seen between them. I mean, he seems like, you know, an abusive and unpleasant husband to be around, but it's so much deeper than that. What do you hope that the audience takes away about Buntaro from this scene? So I feel like every time we see him, there's like a new element about this guy that kind of comes out.
The thing that is really fun to write about Buntaro and to explore with Shin, who plays him so perfectly, is in spite of everything, Buntaro truly, truly loves Mariko. And really, that's his greatest flaw, is just how much he loves her, because he holds her so tightly and wants to protect her in such a way that it actually limits her ability to be who she is and to pursue the mission that she actually believes in. The best way I've heard it put was that he keeps her in an invisible cage. And I think that he does that not out of a need to control her. I really think that his need is to protect her from dying, to keep her alive. But of course, that is an act of control. And that is an act of denial of who she really is and what she really wants. And I think that so much of Buntaro is based on that fear of losing her. And there's a long way to go in that relationship now that certain cards have been turned over in this episode.
Yeah. This scene also relies so much on the kind of language barrier and just the difficulties of communication that are a huge part of the show and part of almost every scene of this show. And watching it back, I was really appreciating how kind of differently that is deployed in different scenes when it needs to be. And this, the first one I thought of was the first translation scene between Toranaga and Mariko and Blackthorn in episode 2. And this is just such a completely different way to kind of play with that translation, the kind of weird game of telephone that goes between these three people.
Yeah. And normally in the movies that I can think of and the television shows that I can think of, if there's ever an act of translation that is being presented on screen, for the most part, it's the kind of thing that we as filmmakers wish would go away, right? Like it's oh, if only these characters could actually communicate, then we wouldn't have to, you know, have this third party sitting there talking in such a way. In Shogun, I think part of what's so fun is that third party is such a crucial part of the scene, especially in this dinner scene, especially when, you know, we know that Blackthorne and Mariko have had this night together and have this these feelings for each other. She's left in this position to neutrally translate between the man of the house and the man of her house, the honored guest of this dinner. And she has obviously a lot invested in this situation. So her choice in what to translate, what not to translate, how to translate, what she translates, all of that is crucial information and speaks to why the two languages on this show are so essential to keep partitioned, because the act of translation is a drama in and of itself. And that, you know, someone who would ordinarily be kind of in the hands of a lesser writer than James Clavell or a lesser actress than Anna Sawai might be wallpaper in a scene is actually very much a crucial part of the scene.
So at the end of the episode, there's this earthquake, which is a major event in the novel. And it does kind of feel like this turning point in the story now that we're kind of at the halfway mark. And it's this huge moment for Toranaga and Blackthorne. So can you tell us a little bit about like what the earthquake means to you?
This is a moment when something had to seismically give. It couldn't just hold on anymore. You know, this episode sits on this idea of the wa of the household, right? The kind of this feeling of stability that is just kind of being disrupted by a confluence of factors. The affair that Mariko and Blackthorne were having, the arrival unexpectedly of Buntaro back into the story, Yabushige and his search for a spy that was eventually going to lead to Miraji. And somehow something had to happen that would just kind of readjust the land and hit a bit of a reset button. And I think Toranaga, who of course is aware of everything, you know, in this world, just kind of, I think, is reacting on such a beautiful level to it all, the absurdity of it. His laugh when he sees the sword, the Fugazi sword that, you know, Blackthorne kind of hands him, I think is such a beautiful moment. And it speaks to the truth of what Mariko said, which is that, you know, you give it meaning through your words and your actions. And I think he just finally had to kind of, in spite of the fact that there's obviously going to be a huge casualty to the earthquake and a ripple effect as it relates to Toranaga's army and his power struggle with Ozaka, there's also something just very much about the embrace of life in that moment.
Do you have a favorite scene or moment in Five that you want to make sure the viewer catches?
I just hope that the audience of this show is keying into the wonder that is Fuji as performed Moeka, because she is, you know, this fourth party in the scene during that dinner scene, someone who is, and it really sort of pushes the question that we constantly come to on this show, which is, again, the matter of agency. Who has agency in a scene? And, you know, while editing this episode with Aika, our wonderful editor of our second block, we were constantly just going back to our coverage of Fuji, who doesn't have she's got one, two lines in the entire scene, but she steals the scene from three great actors. You know, it's such a great battle. And her reaction shots, I think, speak to the fact that she does have agency in this scene. But it's an agency that requires neither saying nor doing anything. And I think that's kind of a uniquely feudal Japanese presence and something that you just, you know, you can't get in a modern day scene. So she really makes the most of it.
As Blackthorne's consort, Fuji is in a uniquely tough spot in this clash of cultures, often caught right in the middle of things. Speaking to me next is the actor who plays her.
Hi, I'm Moeka Hoshi. I'm a Japanese actor and I joined Shogun as Fuji. I will try to speak English, but I will switch to Japanese in the near future.
Okay, that's totally okay. Fuji and Blackthorne have a very complicated relationship, or it changes a lot as the series goes on. What was it like working with Cosmo, plays Blackthorne? Like, how did your working relationship with Cosmo change as you filmed the series?
We didn't speak that much through the shooting. Actually, in my acting with Cosmo, I felt that something can be conveyed just by making eye contact with him. Mm-hmm. I guess Fuji and Blackthorne gradually came to understand each other and built a relationship of trust in the way like that, beyond language.
Yeah, not just words. Yeah.
Yeah.
So much of Fuji's duty is about maintaining the wa of the house. This is a big part of her job. And in this episode, in episode 5, the wa is destroyed. There's just between the pheasant, the dead bird, and Buntaro's return, everything's just like super stressful. How did you kind of try as Fuji to maintain the dignity and peace in the house, even though, you know, everything was so crazy?
So this
Women in this era had to be very patient. It was a male-dominated society, and this was a particularly stressful time for Fuji, especially when it came to the pheasant. But she works hard to stay calm. She admires her staff, and they work together to try and keep things peaceful. Fuji also knew that Marika was in great pain, and she was sympathetic because of her own painful background. This bond helped Fuji stay strong.
Can you explain what happens with Uejiro, the gardener? Like, why does this dead pheasant, which was a gift from Toranaga to Blackthorn, we might remember, why does that lead to Uejiro's death?
They had to follow the order no matter what. Blackthorn was clear that if anyone touches the pheasant, they die. So when Uejiro does it, he had to be killed. That was the rule of the Sengoku period. It's hard to believe that happened in the past, now that we live in modern times. It's really kind of insane, but that was the rule of the era. Even Fuji was involved with the touching of the bird, so she also had a responsibility to follow the rule, and that's why she demanded to be killed as well.
What are you most excited for people to see in Shogun overall?
The nature of Shogun is that every character goes through some transformation. Maybe they grow or do something defiant, and that includes Blackthorn. And as he learns, so does the audience. The viewer sees Japan's Sengoku period culture and samurai culture together with Blackthorn. I can't wait to see how people respond seeing the samurai customs given how different our world is today.
How do you think Fuji changes over the course of the series?
Fuji lost her husband and her son, so she was suicidal. But when she gets the job to be Blackthorn's consort, she starts to find a kind of purpose. She hates it at first, but also finds it rewarding. And when she starts living with Blackthorn, even though he's called the barbarian, she realizes he's a human being like her, and begins to feel a warmth towards him. Not a romantic feeling, but they start to understand each other, and that is kind of her transformation.
Within a Japanese home in the Sengoku period, there was a delicate balance of responsibilities and customs that maintained what was known as the wa, or peace, of the household. These included correctly seating guests, preparing the right foods, and most of all, following the word of the head of the household to the letter. As consort, maintaining the wa fell to Fuji. She was in charge of the estate, keeping track of finances, and managing Blackthorn's chaos through her staff of 5, a lady-in-waiting, a housekeeper, a cook, an assistant cook, and the gardener. Countless unspoken rules drove Sengoku households, many of which are still practiced today. Shoes were removed indoors, the seams of tatami mats were never stepped on, and meals were carefully orchestrated. Diners would be seated on the floor, each brought a tray with individually portioned servings in covered bowls. The kamiza, or seat of honor, was given to the highest-ranking guest, generally facing the garden, while the lowest-ranking person sat opposite, near the entryway. But these delicate dynamics of the house were lost on Blackthorn, who's still figuring out the ins and outs of his new role as Hatamoto, a position he never asked for.
He doesn't really have a choice in any matter. whether it's what he eats or who his consort is or what his rank is.
This is Cosmo Jarvis, who plays Blackthorne. At this point in the story, Blackthorne is grappling with many aspects of his new life, but one of the most confusing for him is his relationship with his consort, Fuji.
So in terms of the acceptance of Fuji, I think it blends into the general powerlessness that he's experiencing throughout most of this series. He just has to accept it because there are people in charge and the people in charge have said, you've got a consort. But I think every time that he gradually, incrementally accepts one of these new ultimatums in good grace, something usually good comes from it, or something comes from it. In this case, something very good came from it.
Yeah. You brought up the limitations of, you know, his choice at this point in the story, that he's sort of been locked into this role. And this becomes a big issue when Buntaro returns. I guess, how is he navigating all of this sort of sometimes unreadable interpersonal drama going on between these people?
At this particular dinner, it's probably Blackthorne who has the easiest job. Because presumably, given what Mariko did with him when she thought she was a widow. I mean, it doesn't even matter what Blackthorne thought, really, but at least Blackthorne knows now that Buntaro's alive, he can find some level of comfort in the confidence that Mariko isn't going to divulge anything to this guy, because that would be a catastrophic error. So the only remaining hurdle for Blackthorne is to literally moment to moment sort of navigate the dinner and do it without giving any indication whatsoever that he feels one way or another about this man's wife, and also doing his utmost to maintain the facade of respect that he now knows this country and these people hold such stock in. So it's just a very awkward dinner party.
Once they kind of start this drinking game, it feels like there's definitely some sort of sense of competition or one-upsmanship between them.
Yes, I think that by allowing himself to become inebriated in the way that he does, Blackthorne makes a mistake. And especially given that Buntaro harbors a palpable disdain for Blackthorne from the very first moment they ever meet each other, and not just for the fact that his wife is living in Blackthorne's house, but also in general. He hates him because he's a foreign barbarian, and he hates him because he looks funny, and he hates him for so many reasons. So Blackthorne's decision to become inebriated in this case, even though it may have had a short-term payoff in terms of making a point that Buntaro can't drink as much, it opens the gateway to Buntaro having an avenue to allow his temper and feelings to emerge.
And Mariko is also very, you know, strongly discouraged him from doing anything, which just feels so against his instincts.
Yes, it's torturous. Yeah. The amount of restraint that he is advised to embody by Mariko. But maybe that's what it's about, in part.
There's the earthquake at the end, which is just a huge set piece. And seemed, you know, like a massive just physical thing to go through as an actor.
Well, it was divided up into sections. The first section, pre-earthquake, was a scene between Toranaga, Mariko, and Blackthorne addressing the aftermath of Wejiro's death and about how that had basically confirmed to him that any effort to assimilate in this place was just a waste of time. And based on the fact that they would kill an innocent man over something as pointless as a bird, I think it really disgusted him because he hates unnecessary violence and death. And right in the middle of that, this earthquake happens. And so we sort of stopped shooting that scene at the edge of the cliff right as Toranaga disappears. And then the second piece was done. They built a cliff. They built a huge cliff. I think it was made of foam with pieces of mud and trees. And
oh, wow.
And then we kind of had to run down to the bottom and find Toranaga, and that was actually one of the fun days because one of the operators put a camera down in the mud and was like, do you think next time you throw yourself down there, you could, might be able to sort of fall and put your head near where the land is? So I tried doing that, and I think maybe they used it. But it was basically just like, you know, the sort of stuff you do when you're a kid, just hurling yourself down a huge foam cliff. There were plenty of logs to trip over, and there were plenty of kind of rock faces to fall over. And it was one of those days where you don't really have to do anything psychological because you're just throwing yourself down a cliff. And it was great fun, actually. And I can't believe they built a cliff. I'll never get over that.
Yeah, it's one of those scenes in the book where you're just like, what does this even look like? Because it's described as like the world almost coming apart. And then in the show, the world the world is coming apart.
And I know that some of the stunt coordinator Loro's team, they were put on a cliff with, I think, sheets that were pulled out from underneath them to give the illusion that the mud was being displaced, the ground was being displaced.
And yeah.
So you'd had guys on dressed sort of sheets or tarps or something, and then they were pulled with cables as though they were sort of on large pieces of earth that were moving. And yeah, the stunt team had a hell of a lot to do that day.
And at the end of all that, you know, Toranaga loses his swords and Blackthorn gives him Fujis, which we've learned the backstory of them, and they're not exactly what they seem. What's the significance of Blackthorn giving him these, you know, supposedly worthless swords?
I think that all Blackthorn is doing in that scene is essentially killing birds with stones. He knows that Toranaga is now post-earthquake lacking swords in a culture where swords are extremely important. Blackthorn does not need his sword, so he gives his swords to Toranaga, which is the first bird. But at the same time, by giving them to Toranaga, he is giving them a worth, which Mariko had previously declared was nothing. And in giving them to Toranaga, Blackthorn can also kind of comment on the futility of thinking it's significant, that Mariko's statement about them being insignificant was significant.
Mariko, Blackthorn, and Toranaga are all characters rooted in Japanese history. But it's James Clavell's novel from the 1970s that popularized the story with Western audiences. And it's a book whose impact goes beyond the best-selling page-turner.
This novel kind of set off this whole Japanese trend, right? Sushi trend, kimono trend, the whole martial arts trend.
This is Mako Kamitsuna. She was a consulting producer who worked closely with the creators to provide a Japanese perspective on production.
I thought this might be a very good opportunity to remake this project now to really, you know, put up the mirror for the Western audience and Western people to look at their own history of dominance and colonization.
So we're talking about episode 5 this week, which a lot of it takes place around Blackthorn's home in Anjiro, and also the introduction of Buntaro, Mariko's husband, into this already kind of shaky dynamic that he has in his house and in the town. And Fuji mentioned something about a vengeful tatarigami. Do you know what that is? Because she's talking about that in terms of the house being cursed.
I think there's multiple things at play. Japanese people in general have thought any foreign intruders as an omen, right? So I think that was a generally held threat against anything foreign. And I think that includes, you know, barbarians, Anjin-san, and whatever Anjin does, including, you know, pheasants and rabbit eating diet. Also, in Japanese, we have this notion of when there's an omen, your household will be hit by white arrows. When white arrows hit your entry door, it means your house is cursed. So that's something that I instantly thought of when Buntaro hit the two arrows and hit the pillar of the entranceway. Yeah. When Japanese people sees that, it does gives off a bad luck omen that this place is cursed.
Oh, that's so interesting. I did not know about the arrows thing, the curse. Yeah. I always kind of wondered about Buntaro and his skill as an archer, because that's such an important part of, and in the book, he's just like unmatched. And, you know, he obviously does this thing where he splits a single arrow. It's just like superhuman. But I always wondered if there was some sort of significance to his thing being archery, because most everybody else is, you know, uses a katana, but he's a skilled archer.
Maybe that was subliminally what Buntaro is saying. I mean, he did start it out, this kind of two guys, right, machismo game over the dinner table. Mm-hmm. And it escalates to his show of archery.
Yeah.
But maybe there is a subliminally, he's thinking, well, this place is cursed, you know. And he just hit those two arrows.
Yeah. It's such an intense scene. And it really kind of, you know, we've had questions up to this point, I think, about the nature of Buntaro and Mariko's marriage. And, you know, there's a lot of history that sort of comes out in this episode. And well, their marriage is obviously a very specific situation. But what was sort of the general power dynamic between a husband and a wife at this class level at that time?
So I always felt that how Western people sees Japanese women, there's already a certain bias to just because, right? That because they behave a certain way. They don't talk too much. They're very quiet, very demure. Mm-hmm. But politically, during this time in Sengoku Jidai, women have always been a pawn to a political game. So women, they're very aware of their political duty, and they have to be smart about what to say, what not to say, what to listen, what to retain, what information. They're kind of a domestic spy, in a way, depending on the circumstances. Mm-hmm. Right? So I wanted to keep the perceptive norm about how a Japanese woman behaves. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to keep the smarts. I wanted to keep the smarts. I wanted to make sure that each woman have a smarts behind. Mm-hmm. This is a very high stake household.
Yeah.
They're very close to Toranaga's servitudes. They're pretty high up people.
Yeah. You start to realize by the second episode how interrelated everybody is, how, you know, this Toda family is, part of everything.
Oh, that's another thing.
Yeah.
So Buntaro is not only a guest to this household.
Yeah.
He's Fuji's uncle.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Family member. So that also very complicated.
Before we wrap up, I was wondering if you had any favorite detail, whether it's a historical one or an art department thing from this episode, from 5, that you would love for people to notice if they haven't.
What would that be? Do you have? What about you?
Well, I always liked when Mariko and Fuji were eating privately, just because I just thought it was such a kind of a little behind the curtain scene. And I like their relationship a lot. Yeah,
I like Stone. Blackthorn putting the stone back up after the gardener died. There's something, the indication of beginning. He doesn't know what he's doing it for, but there's a beginning of respect.
Yeah.
For something that he doesn't even know what that is yet.
Yeah.
That's all for this week's episode of Shogun, the official podcast. Next week, how will Toranaga face Ishida without an army? Where can Mariko and Buntaro's marriage possibly go from here? And will Blackthorn's cooking skills ever improve? Tune in next week as we discuss episode 6 of FX's Shogun. You can find a link in our description to episodes 1-5 of Shogun. And if you want to dive deeper into the world of our story, check out the official Shogun Viewer's Guide. There's a link to that in our show notes as well. Be sure to rate, review, and follow Shogun, the official podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Emily Yoshida, and I'll see you next week.